reconvening the joint House Revenue and the Senate Government Committee, and we're very pleased to have with us today our State Treasurer and Chuck Smith in the Treasurer's Office. This next item on the agenda comes about, I think I may have raised the question at some point, and others were interested too, how the Oregon bond rating, well, obviously it's made by the bond rating companies. We wanted to talk about factors going into the bond rating consideration. And so we appreciate the fact that you folks have joined us today and you've done a little research for us and can present some information. So good afternoon, Mr. State, or good morning, Mr. State Treasurer. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to be here. Clearly, we all collectively have our work cut out for us after the last presentation, and we have a lot at stake here. And I think there's a nice segue about how we manage our finances here and how that affects not only the state's credit, but our ability to issue bonds. This is really a tool that you have in your tool chest that really does make a difference in the state of Oregon. And we've historically used bonds to build infrastructure to improve the quality of life in Oregon, whether that's for parks, housing, transportation. Last session, you made some initiatives that were also, I think, very important for the state, and that is to make some investments in the intellectual capital of Oregon through higher education, Oregon Health Sciences, for example. You're looking at potentially issuing some general obligation bonds that will put $200 million in expanding their biomedical research, which, again, is a very important long-term investment for the state. It's a very good tool that not only does the state use, the private sector uses to make these types of investments. We're here to give you an overview both of how this process works here in the state and also to help you with any future decisions you use want to look at in using these bonds. I came before the House Revenue Committee last session to talk about how we might help a critical need with our public schools, and that is around the capital needs of our schools. The Secretary of State's office did a report, in fact, in late May, documenting the growing need and the financial need of our public schools and their capital. And again, I would look forward to working with you next session, and we'll talk a little bit more about how that worked perhaps later in this presentation. But a critical need in the state for our schools and our children. And of course, you also were able to last session put some money in for transportation. The first time the state's looked at a $400 million bond measure, the largest the state's ever made on behalf of transportation, a good investment in the infrastructure, a good tool to help them and help us with that need. And again, we have some capacity, a policy decision maybe, to try to add additional money to that. With me, I have Chuck Smith, and there's some others that will present, and also to give you an overview of how we manage the state's bond process. My role in this is pretty simple. I am the interface between the agency. Once you give the direction to the state agencies that you want certain things done through debt financing, my job is to work with the agency and the private sector to issue bonds, make sure that we get the lowest cost of borrowing, and that we get that we guarantee that we pay these bonds. And that's the point where it directly relates to our credit rating. Oregon generally has had a very, very strong credit, a AA, and you'll hear more about what that means. But what it really boils down to, it provides the lowest cost, or one of the lowest costs in financing for us to do these infrastructure projects. It, in essence, reflects the risk and the ability for the state to pay, and translates into taxpayer savings. So the better the credit rating, the lower the cost of interest, hence the lower cost to the state and taxpayers. So it's a very important piece of the financial puzzle for Oregon. And another thing that's become even more important about the state's credit, which, again, I think we always have to keep in mind, it's a new program that we started a few years back. The legislature passed a program that's run out of my shop called the School Bond Guarantee Act that allows school districts now to borrow against the state's better credit. Most school districts don't go to the marketplace that often. This way we have a strong credit that they can come to us and apply and say, we in essence say we will guarantee this bond issuance. The state has a great, or school districts have a great track record in paying their bonds. It's a very low risk to us, and it's a great service to school districts. We've seen almost $1 billion go through this program. Nearly every school district has used it, and the cost savings to school districts and the property taxes that are being paid is about estimated around $100 million. So here again, it's really important for us to keep in mind that state's credit, while it maybe seem a little arcane, has a direct impact on all of us, not only in this building, but to the communities throughout Oregon.
I'm just curious, when you say the $100 million, can you sort of identify, not at this particular point, but it would be available to get a picture district by district of those who've been involved with the program to see what those say? Now, I assume that those are, you have to guess a little bit what they might have gotten, or do they have a bond rating, and you can compare that pretty easily, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. Each school district at some point has issued bonds. Some school districts haven't been in the market for years, and so you don't really know maybe specifically, but most school districts have a lower than a AA rating. There are some that do, but most of them do not, in which case there's where the savings comes. If you have a lower rating, you're going to pay more in interest.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck Smith can maybe document at some point later in his presentation.
I want to do a lot of work.
And we could give you some information as well and hand that out. But it's been a great program for the state and for school districts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Chuck, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm Director of Debt Management of the Oregon State Treasury. I'm going to be talking about bond matters here in the next few minutes, and what I'd like to do, I will refer occasionally to these two documents that were paper clipped together and provided to each member of the committee. And rather than walk through them page by page, I would just I'll give you a few very quickly, and we're going to take a look at a particular page that maybe help focus some attention on a particular aspect of bonds and bonds ratings. But really what I'd like to talk about this morning are sort of three areas here. I'd like to talk certainly about bond ratings, including factors that affect bond ratings. I'd like to talk about the state debt management process in total, just quickly review that for the committee, and also talk about bond capacity. How many bonds can this state sell? First of all, I thought, since we're spending a lot of time talking about bonds here, I thought maybe, what is a bond? So I copied down this definition, and if folks don't go to sleep, please, let me just get you into it. A bond is a certificate representing a promise to pay a specified sum of money, called the face value or principal amount, at a specified date or dates in the future, called the maturity date, together with periodic interest payments at a specific rate. Wow. Okay, so a bond's a written instrument that says you owe money to someone, and you're going to pay back the principal and interest over time. But what this definition really doesn't get into is one of the key aspects, or actually several key aspects, of what makes bonding the instrument so important to the state of Oregon. First of all, it doesn't deal with negotiability of bonds. Making loans at a bank, you're essentially doing a non-negotiable private kind of transaction. The state doesn't do that. When the state wants to borrow money, it sells bonds. These are highly negotiable instruments. That means they're readily transferred through a marketplace between owners. That has an important, very important implication for us because the marketability of bonds and utilizing the United States capital markets allows the state to borrow money at the lowest possible cost of all sources that the state would have access to. The bond market is the best, lowest cost way for the state to access capital and borrow capital to make investments. States and local governments have been given the opportunity to sell their bonds at a tax-exempt rate, which simply means that the holders of those bonds do not pay federal income tax, and in this case in the state of Oregon, federal and state income tax, on the interest that they would earn from the bonds. By not paying tax, they're willing to take a lower interest rate than they would if these bonds were sold on a taxable basis. So once again, using the capital markets, using our tax advantage that public entities are entitled to, we can keep the cost of borrowing at a minimum to the state. Well, why do governments borrow? Basically, they borrow to raise funds to make vital investments on long-lived assets like schools, highways, and prisons are examples. But in Oregon also, we borrow for a number of other reasons. We borrow to help low and moderate income folks have safe and sanitary housing. We borrow to loan money to local governments for infrastructure improvements. We borrow for veterans loans programs, and we borrow for a lot of other reasons. So the state is an active participant in the bond market, and we do it for a lot of different reasons. But in each case, what we're talking about is borrowing for long-lived assets and not for any kind of short-term basis. Well, you know, I like to think of bonding as when bonds are used for investments in long-lived assets. Take a road, for example. I like to think of bonding as an intergenerational fairness device. Intergenerational fairness device. And that is because the users or the beneficiaries of this long-lived asset can be the same folks that help pay or carry the burden to pay for the asset. Roads can be built that can last, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. It makes sense, and I think in an intergenerational kind of sense, to not only share the benefits of those kind of capital investments with future generations, but have future generations contribute to paying for those benefits at the same time so that this generation does not have an enormous burden to build a gigantic infrastructure that would last out of the next 20 or 30 years. Well, bonds are issued by a wide variety of folks, government agencies, and private individuals, and so forth, if we're talking about the corporate bond area. But there's different credit qualities of the issuers of these bonds. So rather than all of the thousands of bond investors out there trying to independently determine what the riskiness of any individual bond is in the marketplace, because after all, more risky bonds should sell at a cheaper price or pay more interest than less risky bonds, they rely on third parties to help them make that kind of decision on what the riskiness of a bond is. And the third parties are called rating agencies. They've got the reputation and the experience and the track record, and they're relied upon by large numbers of investors to give them an indication of the credit quality of bonds so that investors can pay the appropriate price or structure their portfolios depending on their own risk parameters that they want to assume. And they don't have to do the research themselves. There are three primary raters of state and local government bonds. There are Moody's, and Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. And these raters have developed a sort of a letter grade system so that it's easily conveyed their judgments on the risk of various bonds. And I'm going to take a look at page one of this document here. We can see the letter grade systems that have been developed. And if you turn to page one of that document, see that the highest credit quality bonds, those bonds with the least risk, most likely to pay off in a timely fashion over the life of the bond, are rated AAA. Down at the bottom of the page, I put down some speculative grade bonds. These are sometimes called junk bonds, and we don't deal in those at the state level. Our credit rating currently is in the AA level. So you can see it's the second one down, which is a very high credit quality. And the state is proud of that rating. That's a good rating, and we work continuously to maintain or upgrade that rating. On the next page, however, I'd like to point out that the ratings have changed in the state of Oregon over time. So if you take a look on page two of this material, we've just put down sort of a history back to 1973 or before of what bond ratings are. You see down that currently we're AA2, which is a medium in the grade AA bond by Moody's. Standard & Poor's were AA, that's a medium, and Fitch were AA. So there's the history of how the bond ratings have changed over time. You can see during the 1980s, the bond ratings were down in the upper A category or A category. a whole series of events, including a severe recession in the state, especially a state bond program that was in extraordinary difficulty, resulted in the state being downgraded at that time. Pardon me? Between the cost? Oh, I'm going to get to that. We're talking about the difference between this and the cost, and we're going to get to that. If you go to a rating agency and ask for a bond rating, they employ a method called four-factor analysis. Every single rating agency does what is the standard analyst learns in the business there, and that's the four-factor analysis. The various rating agencies sort of weight factors differently. So that actually, if you went to the three rating agencies, presented them with the same fact patterns, the same information, you might get a different rating from the different agencies because they take these materials and they apply their own sort of interpretation to it. Frequently, they come up with the same rating as the other folks would, the other rating agencies, but sometimes they don't. And especially in volatile times, they may have differences of opinion. For instance, the rating for California currently, they were just downgraded again last week, is AA by Fitch, but it happens to be A by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. So there's some differences of opinion that's called a split rating on what's going on. So in more volatile, rapid-changing economies, there tends to be more volatility or more differences between the rating agencies and their assessment, what's going on. I'm going to be talking about pages 3 and 4 in this document, and page 3 is entitled The Four-Factor Analysis for Bond Ratings, and page 4 is a continuation of that. Well, each one of the rating agencies wants to focus on the economy. They want to talk about financial performance and flexibility of the issuer, debt burden, and administrative factors. But before we leap into that, the sort of, if you get down, work your way down to the basic, the fundamental of a rating is an assessment of a capacity and a willingness to pay your debts. The capacity and willingness to pay your debts. And these are both critical, and various kind of state instruments. Well, we're all, obviously, this is the foundation for all of us. But we have certain kinds of state instruments that are more dependent on the willingness side than other kind of state instruments, and I'll talk about that a little bit later on. Anyway, the economy, listed here, the economic base, this is the most critical element in determining an issuer's rating. Regional and national economic factors, as you folks just spent the first hour of today's meeting sort of discussing, have enormous impact in this area. The performance of the state's economy are tied right to these economic factors, but they take a look at things, demographics, tax base, and composition and output and employment. Just as the state's Office of an Economic Analysis would do when they're trying to assess what the revenue forecast would look like. Second area they would take a look at is financial indicators. One, they want to make sure that you're accounting for your revenues and expenditures correctly. They would expect to have GAAP accounting, audited accounting, so forth. This would be sort of a fundamental. Without that, they're going to be real concerned that you're not providing accurate financial data to them. They take a look at the revenue forecast. They take a look at how the budget is performing relative to where it was when it was adopted. And take a look at your financial leverage or your bonding and equity position. They take a look at other contingencies. For instance, if you had a large pension fund liability, that would go into the rating process. So these are the kind of financial indicators they would take a look at. Next, they would tackle the debt area. They would look to see that a state is making appropriate investment in public infrastructure so that the private sector would have a favorable growth prospect. It's hard to believe, but they've even actually criticized some states for not having enough debt and not making enough investments. An example might be a few years ago, Utah, which happens to be the only AAA-rated state in the West, extraordinarily low amount of debt, and one of the rating agencies suggested that they needed to do more bonding to make more investments to enhance their future prospects for economic growth. I think what really changed in Utah's case is, of course, the Olympics are going there, and they started and they realized they needed a massive infrastructure investment to accommodate the crowds at the 2002 Olympics. So they went into a bonding program, especially for highways. Did a tremendous amount of ripped up Salt Lake City and kept it that way for several years, if you've been down there in the last couple of years. So nevertheless, there has to be a balance between making the important long-term infrastructure investments and having just low debt. There's a reasonable balance for each different entity in that area. Finally, the rating agencies in the final factor, we take a look at administrative factors. They look at, amongst other things, financial management. And Oregon has always received high marks from the rating agencies for managing its financial affairs through good times and bad. This is one of the consistent strong points to the AA rating that the state enjoys. They take a look at tax policies, once again, debt management, financial strategies, take a look at capital improvement plans, they review the budget and so forth. We talk about labor settlements, litigation. So that's a whole variety of financial factors that are put into their sort of deliberations on how they're going to come to this rating. They also take a look at other sort of factors that impact ratings. And one of these factors are the initiative and referendum process. In Oregon, I'd like to turn to page 5. And page 5 is actually a listing. These are from the rating agencies, not from us. We just took the stuff out of the rating agencies to sort of give you an idea of what they think are some of the strong factors and some of the weak factors in the state's bond ratings. And as I mentioned, strong debt management fundamentals. Here's a whole list of things up there. Good fiscal operations and strong revenue performance. I guess they weren't sitting in the meeting this morning. But nevertheless, over the long haul, we have had good fiscal operations and strong revenue performance. But they also take a look at, and I really didn't sort of prioritize these, but they take a look at some of the weaknesses. One of the weaknesses they typically would note is lack of a budget stabilization fund.
Isn't a $90 million carrying forward balance pretty good? No, go ahead.
Apparently it wasn't enough. Lack of a budget stabilization fund. We're now down to one of, and I'm not sure it's either three or four states in the United States that don't have a budget stabilization fund, but this is something they bring up. And also the last sort of bullet point they bring up on a consistent basis is the active initiative process, because the initiative process can impact government revenues or direct government expenditures to other areas, can reduce government flexibility to meet good and bad times. So the rating initiative in the state of Oregon has been consistently or persistently mentioned by rating agencies for year after year. I mean, the initiative process as one that introduces sort of a volatility to the state's revenue and expenditure program. That's really, at times, not directly controllable by the state. I mean, the state responds to this, but nevertheless, it introduces volatility to the rating process. And one of the things that they also suggest is, if you do have an active initiative process, a budget stabilization fund would help mitigate that kind of concern. If they had a good stabilization fund fully funded, that helps to mitigate their concerns about that area. So So anyway, this is the four factors. They put different weights on the factors. They get together. They primarily decide your rating through a rating committee process and determine what the bond rating is going to be. In this case, our general obligation rating, as I pointed out, is AA rated. We have a variety of bond programs in the state, and they're not all rated the same. Our highway bonds are rated AA1, which means they're slightly higher than the state. And we have other bond ratings for various revenue bond programs and so forth. But overall, if somebody says, well, what's the credit rating of the state, what they're really talking about is what is your full faith and credit rating, the pledge of the state's credit. And in that case, it's AA. If you would, I'd like to turn to the next page to...
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Looking at the ones they cite as weak areas, let's say we had corrected some of these things. I don't know. Maybe the word corrected is not the right word, but say we weren't involved with some of these things. And looking at credit ratings, would it make much difference? I mean, we're at a double A right now. You say most states are in there too and may not have this problem. Does it really affect us that much?
Well, Mr. Chair, bond ratings are directly related to interest rate levels and your interest expense for borrowing in the bond market. As an example, if the state were, for instance, let's take a look at the other side, a downgrade, was rated A instead of AA, over a 20-year period, you would have hundreds of millions of dollars of additional interest expense that you would incur because your bond rating was lower than its potential here. And that's literally hundreds of millions of dollars over a 20-year period because the state issues so many bonds a year on average, and you know, you can figure it out. So it does make a difference, and it makes a difference in millions of dollars. If you know, if people said, well, it only makes a difference of a quarter of a percent, well, that's a huge amount of difference if you borrow hundreds of millions of dollars a year for long periods of time. That becomes a huge number. So it's very important that you maximize your bond rating to the highest level that you can, consistent with borrowing needs and other factors.
Then I assume there are ranges within those. Let's say you have a double A, but there are ranges within that double A of the interest rate based on...
Yes, Mr. Chair, there are. For instance, a double A1, a general obligation bond from a state, would enjoy a... A double A1 means high double A, less than a triple A, but high double A. Would enjoy lower interest rates in the bond market than a double A state.
How flexible are those? Is there double A2, double A3, double A?
Well, there's double A1, double A2, and double A3. That means high, medium, or double A2, and low, double A3.
Double A3.
Okay. So there's fine gradations between these, and the bond market is able to distinguish these and charge more or less interest rate depending on where you are in that group.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I will, I mean, that's one of my primary jobs is to make sure that we maintain a strong credit in the state. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not only because of state costs, but now we have this program for public schools that is directly ties to another constituency. Most local government bond issuances aren't tied to the state's credit, but in this case, there's a direct relationship in this case. And it has... implications, it's really more implications of going down than it is going up. The cost savings as you go up to a AAA are smaller, but as you go down the scale, the costs become greater and greater. And those who hit towards the junk bond, as we saw Enron, I mean, you're now talking an enormous amount of interest costs. So you will see me jump out of my seat if we ever start moving off this, because this is a really important part of the state's treasurer's job, but also for you as well, because it really makes a big difference in our finances.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Brown.
Are the bonds that the state of Oregon issue, are they callable?
Representative Brown, yes, they are. We typically issue callable bonds, and they usually have a 10-year non-callable feature, and they're callable after 10 years. This allows us opportunities to do refunding, refinancings when interest rate drops, like they have for the last year or two. We've done a significant amount of refinancing to lower the cost to the state for its outstanding bonds.
In this recent real drastic downturn in interest rates, do we have any idea of how much dollars this is saving us now with the, by being able to recall the bonds, some of the bonds? Anyway?
Yeah, we're actually working on doing some financing of some of the states or refinancing of the state COPs. And if we could accomplish that, we haven't been able to do that yet just because of market factors. We would save $10 million, for instance. That's in today's savings, present value money on the table. So it's important that we keep on top of this, and we do.
Flexibility.
And do these refundings periodically. But we've done much smaller refundings for other, for instance, the Energy Department loans and other types of bonds that we have outstanding. We always take advantage to do refundings when it's economically practical to do so. There's a certain threshold you want to realize some savings before you go through all the expense of doing a bond sale.
Yesterday we learned in the Transportation Committee meeting that with present day interest rates we'll be able to issue $467 million worth of bonds, and as opposed to the $400 million we thought originally, so we can accomplish that much more.
Yeah. Interest rates have a powerful impact on the cost of your financing.
Yes.
Mr. Treasurer, you know that H.J.R. 46 passed the House, ran into some problems in the Senate, and it ultimately didn't pass. And I'm just wondering if you think that a lot of what the economy has done over the last 6 months or so, do you think there's a more compelling story for helping schools for this kind of measure in a coming special session?
Well, I think you, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I do believe this is something that you really do need to be looking at. I mean, the issue of what schools are going through, both in operational, which is the challenge you heard earlier this morning, is I think that's going to be the biggest challenge the state faces, is with a shortfall that size and the mandate, particularly on K-12, which is a new piece of this puzzle since we've seen a recession. Maintaining and protecting our schools is going to be, I think, one of your biggest challenges and priorities. The capital need has been there and it continues to grow. And it, in some states, they have moved forward in putting more capital improvements in their schools in this economic downtime as a way to help stimulate the economy. The need's there, and it's I would argue it might be worthwhile to, again, reconsider this as a possibility.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative. Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that I don't want to let the comment go without saying something about it. I'm uncomfortable with the fact that a third party outside the state of Oregon would say to a state, we'd like you to borrow more money from us, but we would like you to limit the ability of the citizens to remonstrate against more debt. I'm uncomfortable with that concept. I can understand how it could create lower interest rates. It would also create a captive population.
I think as Oregonians, we generally resent outsiders telling us what to do. Another question I have is, and you may have it, do we know the bond rating of each state?
Yes,
we do.
Chairman, sure.
Yeah. Would you like to see that?
I would like to see it, to see how it...
I think they...
Are there many states with the AAA rating?
Mr. Chair, I think probably there's about 8 or 9 states that are rated AAA. And we can get you a list. I don't have the list with me, Mr. Chair, but we'll send over the list for all the states.
Yes, Senator Castillo.
Thank you. On the list here of the commonly cited weaknesses that raise credit concerns and check Oregon's ability to improve its credit standing, do any one of these that you've listed here have more weight than others? Is it the combination of all of these listed that attributes to that? Or say if some of these, a couple of these disappeared, would that have a significant impact on our rating? And which ones would those be?
maybe I could take at least, Chuck may have a more specific answer to how you might rate those by the rating agencies, but I think the first one, by not having a budget stabilization fund or rainy day fund or whatever you want to call it, has been a crying need in the state's finances in general. And again, I think was cited, most states have something set aside. We've relied on ending balance to some extent, and that, as you know, over time, particularly since Measure 5, has been getting smaller and smaller, so we keep getting closer and closer to the end finish of the fiscal year with less and less. That is not a stabilization fund. And I was recently at talked to some of my peers around the country and was told that many are working right now and taking money out of their stabilization funds because it's raining in most states. I mean, Oregon isn't alone, but you heard this number this morning. Those numbers are being similarly seen by other legislatures across the state or across the country, and they're all having to figure out how to make that up. And many states are using their budget stabilization fund. You know, the interesting debate that I've had with the rating agencies and previous treasurers as well is about the whole idea of the initiative process. I mean, that's been in place for roughly 100 years, and we still have a good credit. So I always argue that's part of the political fabric in this state, and it's always going to be there. Mm-hmm. And we've managed ourselves through these things. Voters often make very, very good decisions, and they understand often the implications of some of these measures on the state's finances. So I always personally think that one gets overplayed. California has it. Washington has it. Many states have initiative process, and to be penalized for that because the counterbalance that we, even though we don't have a stabilization fund, we do have very good management process in place. We've always managed our debt very well in those factors, and we've had a diversifying economy, which has been a big change in the state. So we do have mitigating factors that I do think we can continue to play to say we really are a good credit. And in fact, I was in San Francisco last month to talk about that. So again, this is an issue that is a part of my job, but it's really important for you to have a understanding, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about this, why this is germane to you and not just my position.
It's my understanding that one of my predecessors, Senator from Clackamas County, Senator Uren, commented some 35 years after his big push for the initiative referendum and so forth. He said, the only concern I have is, I've been thinking about the potential for abuse is there. And that's why I keep wondering if we may not be, have to be a little bit careful. We may be reaching that level of Senator Uren's concern later on.
Well, let me just say that.
And I certainly am a supporter of the initiative and the referendum.
Mr. Chair, the last political cycle, the credit rating agencies had all sorts of publications about how many measures were on the ballot, and they follow these. They get papers, they get the Oregon papers, so they'll see what the number was today.
I think we had 1/4 of the initiatives in the nation last November were on the Oregon ballot. 1/4 of all the initiatives in the nation.
Do you want to add anything about the priorities?
No.
Okay.
What I thought we'd do is just take a look at a couple of charts that are on essentially 6, 7, and 8, and this document that I think a number of you have seen. The first one before, we call it the ski slope in the Treasury. And just present this to show what sort of key components of our debt are: general obligation bonds and certificates of participation. When you track those from a high of 1986 down to where they are currently, you can see that the state has considerably fewer bonds outstanding with this category than we did in 1986. And this is largely attributable to sort of the unwinding, if you would, of the Department of Veterans Affairs program that at one time had close to 5.8 billion bonds outstanding, and they have maybe 1.3 billion today. So it's sort of unwinding of a large program, but nevertheless, I think a lot of folks think the state's debt is continuously increasing when that's not the case. The next two pages are just some comparatives. Comparatives are important because rating agencies compare all the states against all the other states. It's sort of a comparative analysis kind of thing. They start with their four-factor analysis, but they like to compare you with respect to certain key factors. And on this chart entitled Net Tax Supported Debt Per Capita, you can see that Oregon has a moderate debt. And I'm only comparing here against a select group of states that were actually higher rated than Oregon. When we go to the rating agencies, we like to compare ourselves to higher rated states because we continuously make the push to upgrade Oregon. So why compare yourself against low rated states? Why not compare yourself against the highest? And that's what we do. On the next page, we have net tax supported debt as a percentage of personal income. And once again, you see we have low to moderate debt at 1.6% compared to states with a higher rating. One of the factors that I'd like to talk about is the strong centralized debt management in the state of Oregon. This is really important, and this is certainly is an answer to any outside folks trying to second guess in how many bonds Oregon's issuing or not issuing. And this strong system was put in place by the legislature in 1981 and 1983. Prior to 81 and 83, there was decentralized debt management in the state of Oregon. There was no real the treasurer didn't have a huge role involved in it. Constitutional measures really determined how many bonds could be sold rather than statutory limitations. And agencies essentially went to the bond market as they pretty much saw fit. That turned into a major problem with the Department of Veterans Affairs program, and we just talked about that at that time, selling billions of dollars worth of bonds and not structuring appropriately, which led to a whole series of problems through the 1980s of trying to correct that program, which it has been corrected and put on a very sound basis and continues to operate today on a much different fashion than it did 20 years ago. Nevertheless, the kind of experience that the state had with the veterans program and other programs, sort of uncoordinated issuance going into the market pretty much when they wanted to, was resolved by legislation in 1981-1983 that sort of put really three critical elements to a strong debt management program in place. Number one, it put the legislature in charge of how many bonds were going to be sold, specifically over a biennial period for each individual program. And to this day, the legislature passes a bill, we like to call it the bonding bill. I've included a copy of it, it's House Bill 2276 at the back of this material. And to this day, each program is limited in the amount of bonds that they may sell during the coming biennium. Whether they have a higher constitutional limit is not the point. The fact is that the legislature has examined their budgets, has examined their intent to use this financing mechanism, and has determined that this is the total or the maximum amount, dollar amount that each agency may sell. And so since 1981 and 83, there has been a bonding bill. Secondly, well, where do the numbers come from to start with the bonding bill? They come from the governor's budget. The agencies go through the governor's budget process and present their needs based upon their understandings and charge from the legislature of what their program should be about. They go through the budget process. The governor adopts a budget and presents it to the legislature for the initiation of discussion on bonding limits as well as the entire rest of the budget area. And finally, when the governor and the legislature have come to agreement on a maximum amount of bonds and passed and signed the bonding bill, the state treasurer enters into the process by making sure that we enter the capital markets in an optimum fashion to achieve the lowest interest cost for state borrowings, to make sure that we have organized, consistent presentation to rating agencies and to investors as well so they understand the state's story, to make sure that state agencies are not bunching up their bond sales all at the same time, spread them out so that we have a better opportunity to achieve the lowest interest rates in our bond sales, and to generally interface with the capital markets. So when you put those three elements together, you wind up with a very strong and well-respected, centralized and well-managed financing mechanism. Other states have actually approached us and asked us about our financing mechanism, and how we've done it in the past, and what are the key ingredients. And those three are the three key ingredients, the legislature, the governor, and the treasurer entering the market in the best possible manner. Another area that I think we're asked to take a look at today is bonding capacity. And I'm going to be just referring just to a couple of pages in this book. This book was produced by the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. The State Debt Policy Advisory Commission was put in place to provide advice to both the legislature and the governor on bonding matters and also determining debt capacity for various state debt programs. The commission is headed by the state treasurer, a member of the Senate, a member of the legislature are also there. The director of the Department of Administrative Services, as well as a citizen, comprised the five-member committee. This committee really, or this commission was really, came out of the 1995-96 legislative period. An interim committee in 1996 took a look at the need for a longer range view of what the state was doing with respect to bonding matters. What's our capacity? Where are we going? What's the longer range? And out of this was constructed a six-year period where we've taken a look at capital needs and bonding to be available to do that. Rather than sort of wander through this report here, I think I like to just sort of cut down a little bit. What the report says is that with respect to our general obligation bond programs, that we have capacity in the neighborhood of about $2.5 billion over the next 5 years, about $500 million. One question I had, that's fine, this capacity, we're looking at about $2.5 billion. How do declining revenues impact the capacity of the state to sell bonds under that? And the answer is, for about every $100 million in revenue decline, you can sell about 60 million fewer bonds. And that would be on an annualized basis, not a biennial basis. So the fact is that while declining revenue obviously is extraordinary or important to the budgeting process, it has less impact on the bonding capacity process. So our bonding capacity, if we were down $300 million in a year for a $600 million in biennium, would be 3 times 60. We would be down a couple of $100 million in bonds and still have very ample bonding. And the reason for that is the state has low to moderate bond debt outstanding. And I showed you that in those charts there a little bit earlier. Because we're in a favorable position, the state does have ample bonding capacity even in declining kind of revenue situations, other factors, revenues to pay for the bonds and so forth. Another area that we provided out in this report is lottery revenue bonds. We're going to get a little report, I think, a little bit later here from Greg Jeffrey about an update on that. But lottery revenue bonds indicated, and the state treasurer sent a letter to each of you during the legislative session indicating that a prudent amount to sell lottery revenue bonds would be about $300 million. The legislature passed legislation that authorized about $274 million in bonds. So that also is included in this report, and you can take a look at that at your leisure. If there was any other additional questions, I'd sure be happy to try to answer them with respect to the technicalities of the bond market and bonding.
Yes, Representative Hayden.
It is sort of technical for a guy like me. Am I hearing that we would have the opportunity, instead of doing some of our projects, capital improvement, out of cash flow, out of current funds, we can bond them and spread the payments out over years?
Celery?
Are you talking about in general?
Mr. Chair? You're saying that...
I'm talking about the ability to address our cash crunch right now.
Oh.
Am I hearing that instead of... Are there things on the table that we would have to pay out of the general fund in this biennium that we could bond and pay it out over an extended period of time?
Capital items?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If there were capital items, Mr. Chair, that were expendable, you were using cash, yes, you could substitute it. But I want to underscore, this is a big red line you don't want to cross, and that is to issue bonds for operating. The rating agencies don't like it. It's a bad use of bonds. Bonds are really to build infrastructure, not to operate. So if you have an operational problem, in this case a deficit, then you cannot use bonds. And then you start crossing into the use and taxableness of these bonds, and it's very messy, and it's something we've never done and we shouldn't do. There are lots of other costs to us if we do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yeah, I was not thinking of operating expenses. I was wondering if there are capital projects that would be eligible for bonding rather than immediate payment.
Of economic stimulus?
You did sort of approach that, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, with the transportation bond package. If you look at that, that was an example of the department had almost always exclusively been on a cash-only basis. You've given the authorization to go out now for $400 million, or now $460 million, potentially, that they would now use the bond to do current projects today and pay for it out of bond proceeds versus using cash only.
I guess the question I'm hearing, Representative Hayden, do we have anything else on the table? Can anyone think of other items that we're talking about using cash, is what you're saying? Could we move it to bonding? Do you know of any?
That's a ways and means question.
Yeah. Probably.
I don't know. He was
already shut down the meat processing plant.
Some of us are still here.
Mr. Chair, I've been assuming all along in this bonding discussion that as we look at the potential for a special session and cutting, that we would be looking in general at a broader package, including economic stimulus, and that there, as the Treasurer mentioned earlier, we could bond for more roads, which would be part of an economic stimulus, or we could bond to replace some old falling apart school buildings while the interest rates are really low, which again would get construction out there, that rather than trying to help us reduce the $720 million, it would likely be out there to help us come to recovery sooner in the state of Oregon so that 0305 wasn't so bad.
Right. Well put.
You had a particular project in mind, too, didn't you?
Well, that's right. I noticed $600 million in that transportation package, and I just happen to have this old bypass that's been hanging around for about 30 years.
I know she's had a bypass.
After I get my interchange.
We can talk. There's extra money in there.
Now, wait a minute. See if I get Sunnyside to take care of it.
And the problem, Mr.
Well, since we have so much money, Bonte, we can do all of them, right? Okay, we should get back. It's a good question there, Representative Hayden. I think you inspired some discussion.
I mean, we'd be happy to look at that as well, and then also to present, I think, is it next week or the week after, there's going to be some committee meetings in the building.
Yes, and you and I are on that.
We would be happy to bring
it
to
us. Yeah,
the four of us are, right? Yeah. We may just make a decision right
now. We'll come back and talk to you about it.
Okay.
Did you have the one bring up, Jim?
Maybe a little more explanation. I was wondering, you addressed essentially Chapter 286-525 with the House 2276. There are some bonding authorizations which are not allowed, notwithstanding this section. This doesn't cover all bonds that can be issued by the state during the biennium. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. Refunding bonds would not be covered under that, and that's because you're replacing one set of bonds with another set of bonds at a lower interest rate. Mm-hmm. Plus, when the legislature creates new programs or expands programs, frequently they will include within the authorization for that particular program, the authorization to sell the bonds. But once the programs are up and running, typically they're included in the bonding bill. And it would be extraordinary not to have them there.
Is the $400 million or $460 whatever it is, for highway funding in this? I thought that was passed notwithstanding.
That's correct.
Well, I think that was just one of those items that were added by the legislature that included bonding authorization within the bill that authorized the $400 million. I don't necessarily think it's on here.
No, I think it was.
Okay, so the other regular 24.
But yeah. I guess, Dick, the fact is that the legislature did review and carefully approve the authorized the sale of those bonds.
But not all in the
they're
same
under the practice. Legislature's yeah. purview, no matter what. And typically, they'll be in the bond bill.
If that's where I was leading in the yeah. sense of, is that all right, or is that, you know, is there any concern with that?
I think that's fine. And I think folks outside the state would say that's a good, tight control process.
Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Jeffer. I'm the finance manager with the Department of Administrative Services. And on that point, in the legislation, you know, that authorized the $400 million, it's expressly said that it was exempt, you know, from the provisions in the bond bill. So that had to be addressed, you know, very clearly, you know, and directly, you know, that it was not, did not need to be, you know, covered in the bond bill. I've been asked here.
Right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I manage the lottery revenue bond program for the state, and I was asked to give an update on what the status is to the challenge to the Oregon Lottery and the impact on the state's ability to issue lottery bonds. In the way of background, as of right now, there's $454.5 million in outstanding lottery bonds. You know, those bonds were issued starting back in 1994 to issue projects such as the West Side Light Rail, monies that went to K-12 capital projects, you know, other kinds of projects as were designated in the authorization, and improvements to Oregon parks. The total lottery bonds, which were authorized by the legislature in the last session, be issued during 2001-03 was just over $274 million. when that was developed, you know, it's very important for us to develop a schedule, you know, because what you need to do, since we're looking at lottery revenues to repay that debt, is make sure you've got a clear match, you know, between, you know, when the bonds are anticipated to be sold, which translates into what the debt service is going to be, you know, for the existing biennia. And what was expected was that about $60 million would be sold in the first sale, you know, which would be just about now. And then about $80 million would be in the second sale, which was scheduled for September of 2002. And then the balance, about $132 million, would be in the final sale, which would be in the spring of 2003. unfortunately, as you probably, I'm sure you all know, in July of this year, a challenge, you know, was filed in the Marion County Circuit Court to the Oregon, you know, lottery. as a result of that challenge, the sale of lottery bonds were put on hold. in mid-October, the circuit court judge made the decision, you know, that that he denied, you know, the challenge. Because it was filed just simply too late, you know, well beyond the 10-year statute of limits was what he had cited. Of course, the next question is, will that decision be appealed? Well, the good news is that we'll know, you know, because the appeal deadline is Monday. You know, end of business day Monday, an appeal has to be filed. The bad news is the expectation is that it will be, you know, filed. As a, you know, aware of all this and looking at the impact on the state's ability to sell the bonds, we have worked with our bond counsel. You know, these bonds that we sell are exempt you know, under the provisions of the federal tax code. Part of what's required in that process is that a nationally recognized bond counsel provide an opinion regarding that as to, you know, whether or not, you know, the state could move forward. Just recently, he's provided us with his opinion, stating that under the existing circumstances, he cannot provide us with a unconditional opinion, you know, which would permit us to move forward to issue those bonds. Oregon's never issued any bonds with anything other than an unconditional, you know, opinion from bond counsel. What we've heard back from bond counsel is certainly if no appeal is filed, the green light goes back on, you know, and the state can move forward making the decision, you know, about issuing those bonds. but again, with the expectation that the appeal will be filed, it puts us in a position where DAS, working with Treasury, you know, and the Department of Justice, need to look and evaluate, you know, what the best, most prudent course, you know, for the state to be taking. And there are a lot of questions that will come up, and we'll be relying a great deal on the Department of Justice when it comes to looking at that. Like, for instance, would the state want to ask the appeal, you know, court to simply forward, you know, the appeal on up to the Oregon State Supreme Court, or would the state allow, you know, want the appeals court to hear it, but request the appeals court to expedite, you know, their review, you know, of the matter. So those are the kinds of, you know, questions that have been, you know, been considered and are going to continue to be considered once kind of the next step is met, which is the appeal actually being filed and the Department of Justice and the state having an opportunity to look at, you know, the provisions of the appeal itself. So that's where we are.
The courts do what the courts do, but what's, if we don't expedite anything, what's our expert's best guess as to when this process might be over, assuming it's appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we have spoken with Justice about that, and again, they're not in a position to, you know, say it precisely, but their estimate would be it would could perhaps be the summer.
Now, last biennium, we prioritized, we had a priority list for lottery bonding. And when we issued bonds, the first, you know, whatever, the first three went, and then you knew if you were number four that the next time the state issued bonds, assuming your project was ready to go, that you were there and so on. Do we have such a list for this biennium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, you're exactly right. The way the authority read for issuing lottery bonds in the last biennium was to authorize something in the area of $112, you know, million dollars for certain projects. This was in addition to the ones issued for K-12 purposes. Mm-hmm. But the law went on to say that only $70 million, you know, even though, you know, the purposes for which it could be issued added up to about $112 million, you know, the law said that only $70 million, you know, could be issued during the biennium, and it kind of ranked the priorities. That wasn't the case in the authorization that was passed by this last session.
Is DAS doing anything? I guess I'm working on the assumption here that ultimately the lottery stands. And if it does, then our bonding would go on, but it would have been delayed for quite a while. You then have a lot of anxious people out there who say, me first, me first. Are you working on a plan for, I mean, assuming we're not going to issue the entire amount right off the bat, who's in the first amount, and are we working on some process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, there are already a lot of anxious people out there.
There are. You bet.
When are we getting our money? When the schedule that I referred to earlier was put together, you know, each of the specific projects in each sale and how much was identified as a part of that.
It was. Okay. Yes. So, and you would continue with that then? Or would you?
Well, Senator, we now, you know, the only bright side, you know, of this is the delayed sale, you know, will reduce the debt service, you know, impact for this first biennia that we're in now. So that may, you know, that will offer us some flexibility, perhaps, in increasing the size of the first sale, you know, to, again, take up what was authorized for debt service. I'd say, I mean, we've spoken to the agencies about that, but until we know, until we have a better sense of exactly, you know, when we're going to be able to organize a sale, that's kind of where we are.
Senator Castillo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us an idea of what some of those projects are that are on hold right now as we're waiting to see what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Castillo. Well, the projects that had been in the first sale, you know, had been $30 million for the local infrastructure. There was a total package of $150
million
in local infrastructure that economic development, these are loans and grants that economic development makes through their bond bank efforts.
Stimulate things a bit.
The second one was some planning funds for State Fair.
How much? I didn't catch the figure.
For in State Fair, it was about $1.3 million. The next project was the short rail. $2 million was going to be raised for the short rail effort. Short rail is a central planning operation that Department of Transportation organizes to facilitate small rail projects.
I'm just, I wish it wasn't one of the ones on hold, I guess is what I'm thinking.
The other project was raising $4 million for Oregon Public Broadcasting. The next was raising about $9 million for a facility on the Eastern Oregon University campus. And the final one was raising $10 million for funding for the Housing Incentive Fund, which makes incentive dollars available to distressed and rural communities.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
What's the status of the commuter rail funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, that was always, well, I'm sorry, I missed an item in the first sale. In the first sale, there was $200,000 in lottery bond revenue or proceeds scheduled to be raised for the Department of Transportation to use in planning, in working with Washington County. For that project, the $20 million in project funding was always scheduled to be raised at the end of the biennium.
Yeah.
You said 20 or 2?
20.
That was 20.
For the project itself, the planning fund.
Toward the end.
Yeah, they get $200,000
off the plan. Other questions? Anything else that you folks want to add today?
Just one more item, and then just to conclude, you have before you some information, and we touched on it a little bit earlier about general obligation bonds, and in particular helping K-12 schools there's something the House Revenue Committee heard in depth and passed out the bill to get the authority for the state to be able to issue general obligation bonds to at least have the state, you, to have the tool to help public schools if you so chose, assuming, of course, the voters supported that. And as I mentioned before, there's also an executive summary by the Secretary of State's Office Audit Division that looked at the capital needs of our schools, talking about the difficulty school districts are having in meeting these ongoing obligations, whether it's creating new schools, particularly in fast-growing districts, or being in situations where you have old schools that have been, you know, were built years ago. And this is a statewide problem. This is not in one particular area. I think we all know where they are. They're in every one of your districts. So the idea here was to have the state become a partner with school districts and having a tool to be able to help share some of the cost of building or remodeling and upgrading our schools, to be able to offer money beyond the credit rating that we do, but they literally issue bonds that would then help match school district bonds when they got them passed. And I think that was the key point here, was that the state wouldn't give money to school districts unless they made a commitment locally to help pay. And again, it's to try to find a balance between local control and state. But the partnership is something that I truly believe has got to happen in the state long term. A colleague of mine in Wyoming was telling me about a case in which their state was sued over inequities in the capital disparity within her state in Wyoming. And as a result, the court not only said that the state has to fix it, but they have to meet a certain standard, a certain type of building as the building standard. And they're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars to have to try to meet that standard within a time period. So I'm not suggesting that we have a court case and that's there, but the inequities that we've all been concerned about in operating, that is in the day-to-day operations, also exist in the state on the capital side for a variety of reasons, basically the same reason. That is, property taxes vary all over the state, and that is the primary funder for K-12 infrastructure, and it is at the local level. And one other thing that has changed over the recent years that we all know about as well is Measure 50, which is now you have to have double majorities, which has made it even perhaps more difficult at times to get school bonds passed. So the challenges for school districts are immense, not only in operating, but in the capital side of operating their schools. And again, this is, I believe, the state, now that we put billions of dollars in our school system, which is a relatively, well, since the 90s, a new mandate on us that we fund schools, it really is part of our interest to make sure that the quality of our schools, the infrastructure, is also maintained. And that is something, and it's a policy question, but it's one that I think the legislature last year began to address, or last session, and we'd be happy to work with you again in bringing that forward and having a discussion about what's an appropriate level of a partnership. But the fundamental tool and the cheapest way for us to borrow, as was described earlier, is using general obligation bonding authority. And maybe the final conclusion is, initially we talked to you about doing a general obligation bond for general purposes, schools being part of it. I think the question about lottery and how we may, right now we're in an eddy, we can't do anything until we get some clarity from the courts. Potentially there may need to be something from the legislature. Point is, we're stuck right now. We can't issue lottery bonds, and perhaps in the long term it makes some sense to get away from issuing lottery bonds and have a general purpose, general obligation bond, which then you can plug all these different ideas that you want for economic development to go through. It is a tool that other states have, we don't. So another idea. But again, the point of this discussion was really to not only about schools, but in general, that bonds are a very positive way and a very good way for you to make investments in the state, that for a variety of reasons, and you've heard a list of them, and of course, when we start talking about lottery bonds, now you really see the bandwidth in which you really make a difference in the state. And it's an important financial tool, and from our office and our perspective, it's a prudent tool to use, but it's also one that we manage and have great oversight on, and to make sure that we get the most bang for our buck out of that when we do go to the market. So it's an important tool, and the state's credit is important to all of us, and that's what our presentation was here today. I'd be happy to answer any more questions or come back and talk to you about.
Is there any other questions? Well, I just want to thank you very much. I think it's been enlightening. I think we all have some understanding of bonding and so forth. A lot of us have worked with it through the years, but I think look at the big perspective of the whole thing and how one thing will impact on the other. And as I listened, and I remember the comment from Representative Hayden, you hate having outside forces. You don't want them telling you what to do. But I suppose it's their role is just to give you a rating. And they develop a criteria. And then the bonding companies, I assume, decide whether they're going to loan you the money at what rate and where you're going to be based upon that. And the burden becomes on us whether we can say we can thumb our nose outside. We don't want you to tell us what to do. That's our privilege. But I do think it behooves us to be very cognizant of the things that go into it. And are there things that we should, what's the fiscal impact? Now, I don't know if we got to that today. I think you did say hundreds of millions of dollars, involved with the body rating. But the consideration of our rainy day fund concept, our reliance today on the lottery, all of those factors. I mean, I think we need to be a visionary kind of thing, looking ahead, what's going to be the impact over a 20-year period and how this is going to affect us. Maybe the people ought to understand when you're dealing with an issue. We certainly want to, that's an Oregon way, and that's something we cherish. But realize that when you come up with something, a ballot measure 5, is there an impact along the line that may save you some money here, but may cost you some money in the long run? And I think sometimes even people dealing with initiatives don't look at the long run beyond the particular thing they're trying to do at that particular time. Because those things have all had an impact on us. You talk about the school situation. I happen to be a bit more familiar with that one. You look at the maintenance. Maintenance just went by the wayside completely. You didn't repair roofs. You didn't do anything. And so what you're doing now, you're going to repair. You're going to build a new school. You've just let it deteriorate to a point where you're going to pay a pretty heavy price for it. And so I think that's what the Legislative Assembly, and I worry a little bit with the term limit concept, too, of having people who live with this work with it and understand it and kind of get the big picture. So we may need to continually have this kind of a discussion going on, because I think it's extremely helpful to us. And I wish the message could get beyond even this committee today, because it needs to go to all members of the Legislative Assembly. And I think it really needs to go beyond to the point where people who are heavily involved with initiatives and the general public understands how important this bond rating is to their own pocketbook. And that's what we're talking about, the taxpayers' pocketbook. That's what we're trying to do. I'm looking forward to the committee, the four of us in the Senate, will be on. And, no one wants to be raising taxes. I don't think that's our idea. But trying to look at ways to stimulate. I think there's another committee dealing with stimulating the economy. But then from the revenue side, I think the bonding and things we're talking about here today certainly will be important to us there. So I think you've been very helpful to all of us today. And I want to thank you very much on behalf of I can speak for the House and for the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, we're always available to help in any way we can. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if you want to go ahead and gavel yours, we have just a couple of items of business we can take care of in just a couple of minutes. I do want to thank the Senate members for joining us. It's always a bonding experience for House Senate to meet together.
Well, I think it enhances you, too. I'm going to recess. I'm going to recess the Joint Committee for lunch and turn it back to 1:15. But I'll let boy, this dual committee work is.
What's that? You recessed the Senate committee.
Yes, to 1:15.
I knew you
did. So we're still going.
Yes, and we don't.
Okay.
Okay, I meant to recess the Senate committee until 1:15.
House members, we have in the packet a revised work plan. Paul, do you want to make comments? Does this just incorporate the changes that we made conceptually last meeting?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. One other thing was added, low-income housing as a update and report, and we've been talking with the housing agency, and we'll get a report on their fund and developments there. And the only other thing was on the process. There was a discussion about location of meetings, and so the committee's decision was basically to discuss that at a further time, so I just changed that to pending committee discussion.
I'm sorry. Okay, with that, the chair would move adoption of the amended work plan that is before us today. Is there any discussion on that? Any objection? Okay, the work plan is approved. Committee, the next meeting date, if you want to mark on your calendars, we will shoot for February 28. That will be the date of the March forecast. So mark that. We'll plan on that meeting date, 9 o'clock on the morning of the 28th. And then just to let you know that we had the first meeting of the tax reform work group of the committee yesterday. I thought it was a stimulating discussion, looking at the history of some tax reform proposals, and including the history of their success at the ballot, which certainly informed, I think, the work group members on where the options before us lie. But there will be, it's a good work group. There will be some further discussion on that. Certainly nothing to report back to the committee yet. And the inheritance tax work group has been formed, has not yet met. We will get an overview this afternoon on the inheritance tax issue so that we better understand that as a committee, and then the inheritance tax work group will be meeting following between now and the next committee meeting. That's all I have to report before we go to lunch. Is there anything else, committee members? Okay, thank you. Then we will be recessed until 1:15 as well.
That's a Thursday.